a handful of stocks responsible for the recent rally, but how long can they keep holding up the market?
We are currently seeing the greatest outperformance of tech versus the S&P 500 ever. The previous two times, we even came close to this kind of gap. They were followed by major tech busts. Now, of course, tech looks a lot different now than it did back then. It is more concentrated in a handful of companies worth hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars with real earnings and diversified business models. And it's partly underpinned by that transformational platform shift in AI that has not been seen since the advent of the iPhone, the internet, or the Industrial Revolution, depending on who you ask. Given their size, though, this run-up this year has been astounding. NVIDIA, Meta, they have more than doubled in value. Google is up 14% since that I/O event last week where it came out with its generative AI search model. And Amazon is up nearly 6% this week. So despite, or maybe because of those gains, investors, they're looking for that next big winner in the space.
We have such a bifurcated circumstance throughout the market and tech versus the market. But one of the problems with bifurcation is it's almost always resolved by generally lower prices. And so consider this fact. The Russell 3000, right, represents 98% of the investable capital in the United States. Half the stocks in that index are actually below where they were on the lows of October 13th, meaning we are so dependent on just a few, and that usually ends poorly.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Stocks ended up the week on a positive note with major indexes in positive territory. That came after the Fed may be close to a pause. However, there are conflicting messages coming from Fed officials in terms of another rate hike. Two governors think rate hikes need to go higher, while Chairman Powell squashed that idea on Friday. Meanwhile, the drama over the debt ceiling debate continues, and the deadline for government running out of money draws near as the national debt is close to crossing the $32 trillion mark, with deficits projected to come in this year at close to $3 trillion. Janet Yellen didn't help matters out any by saying more bank takeovers and consolidations are ahead of us. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck, Tom McClellan joins me. Tom sees a short-term market bottom ahead in the next week and a short-term trading rally going into the month of June. But a bigger downturn could be coming this September. Tom sees higher oil prices this fall, and divergences are developing in the major indexes, which is a warning that trouble ahead this summer. After Tom, Doomberg joins me later on in the show to discuss the approaching energy crisis and the lack of foresight when it comes to making a green transition. And finally, Chris Poplavin, Chris Sheridan will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava. Ryan?
Hi, this is Ryan Poplava, market technician and wealth advisor at Financial Sense Wealth Management. And this part of the podcast is where I summarize the key catalysts that moved the financial markets over the past week. To start off, the S&P 500 closed at a new weekly high for the year as stocks lifted on good news in the banking industry and on hopes that the White House and both sides of Congress will come to an agreement on the country's debt limit. The market rose with continued momentum in the technology sector, which was this week's best performer, up 4.3%. Second was communications, up 2.8%. Discretionary was up 2.5%, followed by the financials, up 2.2%, energy 1.4%, industrials 1.3%, and finally materials up 0.7%. Defensive sectors took a backseat, with utilities down 4.2%, real estate down 2.4%, staples down 1.6%, and healthcare down 0.7% as money rotated out of those sectors into cyclicals. As Jim mentioned, earlier this week and in weeks past, there has been a debate whether the Federal Reserve is done raising rates or has it one, maybe two more hikes to go? And possibly, will it cut rates this year as the Fed futures anticipate? Monday, Atlanta Fed President Bostic, a non-voter, said he doesn't expect inflation to fall quickly and that rate cuts this year are not in his forecast. Monday, Richmond Fed President Barkin, a non-voter, spoke in favor of more rate hikes, and Tuesday said he's not convinced inflation goals have been met. Thursday, St. Louis Fed President James Bullard, also a non-voter this year, supports higher rates as insurance against inflation. Finally this week, Fed Chair Powell said that while inflation is far above the Fed's target, he said rates may not have to rise as much due to deteriorating credit conditions, basically the message he gave us at the last policy meeting. But it runs starkly contrary to the other Fed presidents and their comments earlier in the week. The two real catalysts that moved the markets, the first of which was the positive chatter around the banks with the regional banking ETF KRE up 7.4% on Wednesday because of comments from Western Alliance that its deposits increased $2 billion since the end of the first quarter. There has been continued concern over the banks, with PacWest stating a drop in deposits last week that saw the stock plunge on the news. Finally, Friday, CNN reported that Treasury Secretary Yellen told bank CEOs that more bank mergers may be needed, causing stocks to lose some of the gains on the day. The second main catalyst propelling stocks higher this week, or at least most of the week, was continued hopes that Congress and the president would come to an agreement and lift the debt limit. There were hopeful comments throughout the week from both sides, but it was one comment Friday from Jake Sherman who tweeted, "Debt limit talks between the White House and House Republicans are paused, per multiple sources involved in the talks." That reversed some of the positive gains early in the day on Fed Powell's comments. And early in the week, Yellen had said extraordinary measures are needed to pay the nation's bills could be exhausted on June 1st. So a lot of mix, a lot of back and forth, but the news of the negotiation pause and that there may be more bank mergers helped to close stocks down on an otherwise positive week. On the economic front, news was mixed and didn't have a large effect on the markets. It was deemed weak, but not weak enough to move the Fed to possibly cut rates anytime soon. Retail sales for April were up 0.4%, but basically flat, adjusting for inflation. New York Empire Survey plunged to negative 31.8 for May, while the Philadelphia May Survey showed an uptick to negative 10 from negative 31. Industrial production was up 0.5%, helped by output of motor vehicle sales and parts. Housing data for April was also mixed, with housing starts increasing 2.2% in April over May. Single-family starts were up huge in the West, but down in every other region. Building permits declined 1.5% for the overall report, but again, single-family permits were up, but still down for the year-over-year comparison by 21%. Finally, April's leading economic indicators report showed a bump up to negative 0.6%, up from the prior drop of 1.2%. It was a big week in retail reports coming from Home Depot, Walmart, TJX, and Target this week. But starting off with Home Depot, disappointed with its Q1 sales, comparative sales, and guidance for the year, which is now for an earnings per share decline between 7 and 13% below previous estimates. The company's CFO said the drop in expectations comes as a result of the negative impact in the first quarter sales on lumber and due to weather, as well as further softening of demand. Target beat, but called out softness in discretionary spending, much as we've been hearing from the likes of Amazon earlier this season. Target lowered their second quarter earnings estimates below analyst estimates. Walmart beat expectations, but raised its outlook, recognizing the shift in retail demand towards needs, echoing comments from Target. But again, here Walmart is already moving in that direction and cycling into those products that consumers are demanding. TJX, another retailer, beat earnings estimates, now the third time in the last four. What's more disturbing than the shift in needs versus wants that TJX also sees is a change in consumer behavior that's being focused by all retail companies right now. That is retail theft, which is becoming a really big problem. When stores have fewer products than recorded in inventory, the companies call this retail shrink. Target said last year's shrink impacted its gross margin by at least $400 million and thinks it'll affect this year by $500 million. Brian Cornell, the company's CEO, said it is a problem that impacts availability for products, less convenient shopping conditions, and puts their staff in harm's way. As he noted, violent incidents have increased. TJX said the company is laser focused on initiatives to decrease theft with hard cases, tethering, and tagging. In some cases, like in Portland and San Francisco, stores have actually been closed due to crime, as announced by Walmart, Nike, and Nordstrom. But that wraps up this week as the market climbed higher on, again, those hopes that banking relief is in the cards, as well as debt limit increase from negotiations between the White House and both sides of Congress. Finally, we got mixed economics and then also all the reports we heard from the retailers this week. Up next, this week's guest technician is Tom McClellan.
The cyclical picture still remains pretty negative for risk assets. We still maintain conviction in the view that the U.S. economy has most likely entered a recession already. So, you know, where we are today, you know, refreshing the tactical and cyclical picture, you know, again, it feels pretty similar, actually, back to where we were in February, where both the tactical and the cyclical picture are aligned to bet on downside from here.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the markets are responding almost by the hour to every news announcement. Yesterday, you had two Fed governors that said they need to raise interest rates even further. On Thursday, the futures market was projecting a 40% probability of another rate hike in June. But then Chairman Powell reversed that on Friday. Where are we heading with all this? Joining us on the program is Tom McClellan. And Tom, I want to begin with your first chart that you sent. And I just want to let our listeners know, if you go to the company website, we're going to post these charts that Tom and I are discussing. But the first one is the Fed funds rate. What is that chart telling you in terms of where we are today and where we might be heading?
Well, the important point in that chart is a comparison to the two-year Treasury note yield. And for more than a couple of decades now, the two-year note yield knows better about what the Fed is going to do than the FOMC knows. So I long advocated that we should just disband the FOMC, outsource the job of setting short-term interest rate policy to the two-year Treasury note yield. We'd save a bunch of hotel and travel expenses for the FOMC members all having to come to Washington for their 8 times a year meetings, and we arguably get a better response out of the markets, because when the Fed is asleep at the switch and not waking up to what the bond market says, it tends to create problems. Back in 2006 and 2007, the FOMC thought they knew better, kept rates too high, didn't respond when the bond market started falling, dropping yields. Finally did respond with record rapid rate of dropping interest rates, but it still wasn't fast enough compared to the message of the two-year. We're seeing that now there's almost a full point spread between the Fed funds target rate and the two-year. That is a statement about how the Fed is screwing up this particular time. And you can be confident the Fed is always going to screw it up somehow. You just don't ever know exactly how, but they're screwing up by not waking up to the message of the bond market.
You know, you would think after going through this cycle repeatedly and crashing the airplane every single time we get into this, they would start paying attention to this, but they don't. They seem to either keep rates low and loose for a long period of time, and hence, you know, inflation was temporary, turned out not to be temporary. And then they go in the opposite direction, saying the economy's strong, we're optimistic, growth will continue. And of course, we end up in a recession.
And the two-year note yield knows better than they do. If they would be more responsive to the message of the bond market, they would get better outcomes and they wouldn't overstimulate and oversuppress the economy. The Fed is supposed to act as a dampening force, as a counter-cyclical force. Think of pro-cyclical and counter-cyclical. Pro-cyclical is when you push your child on a swing and the amplitude gets bigger. Counter-cyclical is when you are dampening the amplitudes, and that's arguably what we want in the economy. We don't want wild swings. The Fed is supposed to be counter-cyclical and dampening out these wild swings, and they're just not doing a very good job of it because they think they know better. They've got these expensive PhDs. They got 400 PhD economists working for the Federal Reserve, and they're hiring more How many economists does it take? I don't know, but if they would listen to the bond market, they would get better answers and we could arguably get better outcomes.
Yeah, it's kind of like how many PhDs does it take to screw in a light bulb? It's amazing. So when you look at the two-year note is telling you that things are not looking too great on the economy and they're probably overdoing it.
That's the message. And our predictive model, we look at model I didn't share in chart form. It looks at euro-dollar futures. The euro-dollar is an interest rate futures contract. It's not the currency. The euro-dollar term refers to dollar-denominated time deposits in European banks. And we look at the data in the Commitment of Traders report published by the CFTC every week on the positioning of how much of the big banks are either long or short. And what that shows us is about a 10-month leading indication for what short-term rates are going to do. That model is saying that short-term rates are going to peak in July, plus or minus a little bit. It's a 10-month leading indication. And then they're going to dramatically decline late this year. I think that the bond market is sniffing that out and starting to realize it. The Fed has not yet started to realize it because they know better than all of us. But we're going to see a dramatic decline in short-term rates later this year as inflation finally starts to come down. It's not going to come down all the way, and it's not going to come down forever. We're going to see resurging inflation next year, but it's going to be coming down late this year. And of course, the short-term bond market's going to overreact to that and have dramatically lower short-term rates later this year. The Fed just doesn't realize that yet.
Well, maybe some of them ought to go to chart school or maybe read your newsletter. Anyway, let's go on to your next chart, which is spot copper. What's that saying?
Well, not surprisingly, copper has a very strong correlation to bond yields and to the stock market. And so this is a comparison of the price of copper to the New York Stock Exchange Composite Index. That's just an index of all the common stocks that are traded on the NYSE. And this was the subject of a recent Chart and Focus article posted at my website. And the basic point is that most of the time, copper prices and the stock market do the same things. It's when they disagree that things get interesting. And usually when they disagree, it ends up being copper that ends up being right about where both are headed. Right now, we're seeing copper pushing down to making lower lows while the stock market is still making higher lows. And in the case of certain indices like the NDX, it's making higher highs. Not all the indices are doing that. But the message from copper is that there is a poor liquidity out there in the real economy. So the demand for copper is drying up, partly because big businesses can't get loans from banks who are reporting in the senior loan officer opinion survey that they have tightening credit conditions. And so when you can't borrow money to build your big factory or to expand operations, then you don't need to buy as much copper to make motors and electrical components. And so the price of copper comes down. And eventually that illiquidity problem comes and affects the stock market. I coupled that copper chart with one other chart that I sent you, which has the same message. It shows a divergence between stock prices and the cumulative daily advanced decline line. The message is the same. It's about liquidity. What an advanced decline line is it looks at every day's data on the number of stocks that went up versus the number of stocks that went down. The difference between those two is known as the daily breadth. And if you calculate that on a cumulative basis, you get what's known as the advanced decline line. So it moves up and down every day by the daily breadth number. Today, as we're speaking on Friday, we got about 700 more declining issues on the NYSE right now. So that means that the advanced decline line would move downward by 700 increments. And when you see the advanced decline line making a bearish divergence versus prices, it is conveying a message that liquidity is a problem.
You know, one of the issues I think is confusing for investors. Let's talk about how this works. The S&P is a market cap weighted index. So the stocks that have the largest market cap carry the largest weight. And that's reinforced as money comes into an index fund. A good majority of it will go to those top stocks. But Tom, if you take the unweighted S&P that just takes the 500 stocks, it doesn't look that good.
That's very true. You can do the same thing with the unweighted NASDAQ 100 that trades in the ETF known as QQEW versus QQQ, and it's showing a divergence very much like these divergences. What this tells you is that when you look at each and every stock that trades, that represents several thousand different battles between the bulls and the bears. When liquidity starts to dry up, the least deserving issues will suffer first. It's like when you're going to thin the herd of cattle, you kill off the rents first. So looking at advanced decline statistics tells you about what the least deserving ones are also doing, something that gets disguised when you look at just the cap-weighted indices, because right now Microsoft and Apple are still doing well, and so the S&P 500 is still doing well, the NASDAQ 100 is still doing well, but the Russell 2000 is bouncing along the lows of the year because the small cap stocks and the high yield bonds and the price of copper, they're all not able to find sufficient liquidity out there. Eventually, that illiquidity comes around and bites the big guys too, as we saw in 2000 and 2008. The big guys can come down, but they will come down last. It's the small, undeserving ones that are the canaries that die first before the coal miners.
I want to go on to something that really strikes me. I'm looking at the S&P sectors. You've got consumer staples that have been going up. You've got financials starting to tick up. And I'm thinking of the financials to a comment that Janet Yellen made yesterday, saying that we could see more consolidations in the banking industry.
That kind of makes sense that we should see more consolidations, because I heard recently, I think that the U.S. has 4,500 banks. Compare that to Canada, which has five. You know, how many banks do we need? So that's a reasonable question. The argument on the other side of that is that by having more different banks, we have more innovation, lots of different banks trying out new and different things in the great laboratory of the markets, so you can get better outcomes that way. That's a fascinating argument that we could probably settle better over a beer, but I wouldn't be surprised if Janet Yellen is right on this particular topic about more consolidation.
Now let's go to on the inflationary side. I'd like to get your take on gold and oil here.
That's a fascinating question, because gold prices, or the movements of gold prices, tend to get echoed about 19 to 20 months later in oil prices. So if you look back to what gold was doing 19 months ago, it was making a nice bottom and starting to turn up. So I'm looking for oil prices to bottom here. And when I say here, I mean in the big, large terms, and have a big swoop up toward the end of 2023. Now, exactly when is the moment for that oil price bottom? That's a little bit squishy, because when gold prices were bottoming 19 to 20 months ago, it was not a nice clean V bottom. It was a rather mushy, choppy bottom. So trying to pick the exact moment. But we're in a bottoming condition for oil, and I'm expecting a nice swoop up into the end of 2023. And then a little bit of a decline again in 2024. So I'm very excited about getting long oil stocks here very soon, not quite today, but very soon, and riding that to the end of this year. But don't get married to that position, because it's only going to be temporary, but it should be a nice 6-month trade.
Okay. And gold?
Gold prices have broken down out of a big double top structure, and double top structures get technical analysts very excited in the same way that head and shoulders top structures do, because if you imagine the letter M, that's what a double top looks like. And so you've got two tops at roughly the same price, and you've got an intervening low that divides them. That intervening low in gold prices was at $2,000 an ounce based on the August gold futures contract. And so when that intervening low point got broken, that set off the double top and said, okay, we've got measuring objectives for gold down to about 1920. And that's based on the height of that letter M, the height of the double top above the intervening low. So that's the downside objective for gold, is to around 1920. Silver is leading the way lower. It's got a downside price objective of about 2310 for futures. And so both of them still have further to go to reach that objective. They're not making very much progress on that today, on Friday, the 19th of May, because of reaction to what Fed Chairman Powell said about, well, maybe they don't have to raise interest rates as much. So both of them are rallying, but they still have a little bit further to go based on that breakdown.
So you could see oil prices edging higher as we end or get closer to the end of the year. Where would you see gold if you were to take out your crystal ball and we were having this conversation December 31st?
Well, the fascinating thing about gold is it is a great leading indication for lots of things. It leads oil prices and bond yields by about 19 to 20 months. It leads grain prices by about 15 months. I have not yet found the great leading indication that tells me what gold is going to do. It has some slight correlation, interestingly, to uranium prices, So if you watch what uranium does, then gold tends to echo those movements about 7 months later. I have no idea why that should be. It doesn't make any sense to me at all, but that's what the data have been showing for about 30 years. And it's a horribly imperfect relationship. The correlation is evident, but not necessarily something you can make money off of. Generally speaking, high interest rates are not good for gold prices, because if you put your money into gold versus put your money into a 5% money market return, that gold investment you made, you're missing out on earning interest on it. So the higher the interest rate goes, the higher the penalty for owning gold, and that makes people want to own gold less. This is especially true if you look at real interest rates, meaning the interest rate adjusted for inflation, and they've had a long positive correlation between them. That correlation has not worked as well in the last 5 to 10 years as it used to work 20 years ago, but it's still a reasonable principle to consider. So if the model that I'm talking about, that Eurodollar Commitment of Traders model, is correct about interest rates falling dramatically in late 2023, if that's correct, then that should be beneficial for gold, absent any contribution from other factors. But the problem is there's lots of other factors. At the same time, I'm looking for the dollar to gain in value this year. I'm looking for the euro especially to drop in value, and that's based on the positioning of the commercial traders of currency futures. And so that may cancel out any effects of falling interest rates in terms of helping to drive up gold prices, because if dollar gets more valuable, then it doesn't take as many dollars to buy gold, and so that suppresses the dollar price of gold. So you've got a collision of those two forces, and it's really hard to know which one is going to be the larger force at any given time. So I wish I could give you a great forecast between now and the end of the year for what gold is going to do. I don't really have good insights on that because of the conflicting signals. And so I look at it as something to trade, something to follow the trend of, but I wish I had a better answer. I don't.
So given what you're seeing right now as an investor, Tom, what would you be telling investors to do?
I'm looking for an exciting bottom, an exciting trading bottom for the stock market later this month. So not very many days away from now. Today's May 19th. So within a couple of days, probably next week, I'm hoping that we get a nice juicy sell-off to an oversold condition as everybody panics about something, probably the debt talks. And that's going to be a setup for a trading rally in June. And I want to emphasize, not an investing rally, a trading rally in June. And that should benefit stocks unevenly because liquidity is very poor, but this liquidity that's still left in the pool can slosh around a little bit and we can get a rally. There's going to be a more important bottom in late September of this year. That's the one you want to buy, be more of an investor into, to buy and hold into 2024. Late 2024 is going to be really, really ugly for the stock market. So you want to be getting out of your positions generally and figuring out a way to protect yourself or even profit from the coming decline in late 2024. But now's not the time to trade for late 2024.
All right. Well, listen, Tom, as we close, tell our listeners how they can learn more about your newsletters.
Well, I've been writing the McClellan Market Report newsletter with my father, Sherman McClellan. We started in April 1995, so we've been doing this for 28 years. That's been a great privilege that I've had to work beside him and learn from him. He's 88 years old and still doing great. He and my mother, Marion, developed the McClellan Oscillator indicator back in 1969. And so our website is mcoscillator.com. It's just a contraction of McClellan Oscillator. If you go there, you can find out about our twice monthly newsletter and our daily edition. You can even sign up for our free weekly chart and focus email. No strings attached. We won't spam you. We won't sell our list to anybody. It's just a way to make more people aware of the indicators that we use.
And so if I was summing up, Tom, you see a short-term bottom coming in here that may be tradable, but the real bottom, the point where you really want to jump in as an investor, is probably not going to occur till September.
Late September, yes.
All right. We'll end on that note. Tom, thanks so much, as always, for joining us. And we look forward to talking to you once again.
Banks are going to have a major problem during this next bear market that I foresee. And what we saw this year, I think, is only the tip of the iceberg for what's going to be coming.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, if you thought your electricity rates are getting expensive, I hate to tell you, more bad news. It's going to get even more costly, and maybe you may be facing brownouts. There's new mandates coming out that are going to make it more expensive for utilities to keep environmentally free. So let's talk about that. Where's all this heading? Joining us on the program is Doomberg. You know, Doomberg, you wrote a piece called Causal Effects. So like my own state of California, we are basically shutting down nuclear power plants so we can buy nuclear power from Arizona. We've shut down drilling so we can buy more oil from Saudi Arabia. And then we're going green with windmills and, let's say, solar panels, but then you can't get them approved to build them. So how's this all going to work out other than the fact that we'll be facing more brownouts?
Yeah, Jim, first of all, great to be back with you. Thanks for the invite. And as you said, we wrote that piece, Causal Effects, inspired by a really quite amazing article in the New York Times. You know, we were joking a bit before we hit record about how we'll never run out of stuff to write about in this news cycle. But, you know, a couple of Saturdays ago, a most amazing article hit the New York Times, the title of which gives you an indication of where the article is heading. It was called Backup Power, a Growing Need If You Can Afford It. And the article goes on to basically blame climate change for a recent spurt in power outages being observed around the country, as though the grid was just some amorphous thing that was working just fine before the weather changed. And of course, the article is filled with the mandatory nods towards how rich people are better able to insulate themselves from these effects and are buying, you know, gas power generators and whole house generators hand over fist as they correctly recognize the upcoming instability of the grid and are doing whatever they can afford to do to insulate their families from these effects. But missing from the article, completely missing from the article, is any nod, indication, or even a thought that perhaps saturating our grid with intermittent power sources such as solar and wind might be the cause of the instability that they were bemoaning in this piece. And in reality, of course, as they continue to mandate heat pumps to replace furnaces and electric vehicles to replace internal combustion engines, they will be facing this amazing situation where they are mandating increasing demand onto the grid, while at the same time, as you articulated in the base of your question, doing everything in their power to limit the growth and proliferation of stable baseload type power that can actually service that demand. And ultimately, you know, that which can't go on forever usually doesn't. One wonders when we'll reach the political breaking point, but judging from the propaganda coming out of the New York Times, it seems like we have a while to go yet.
Yeah, and even the mainstream media, because like, for example, here for environmental regulations, they stopped the fire departments from doing brush burning and controlled burning to clean out the forest floor. So we have more fires, but instead of blaming it on policy, they blame it on climate change. So climate change seems to be the number one excuse given for everything that's not working with their policies.
Well, it's a catch-all. That's great. You know, if we have a lot of hurricanes, it's climate change. And if we have no hurricanes for several years, that's also climate change. And if it's too warm, that's climate change. And if it's too brutally cold in the winter, that's also climate change. And if we have a drought in California, that's climate change. And if we get so much snow in the mountains that we're worried about flooding, that's also climate change. And so it really is a wonderful catch-all for hand-waving non-scientific political leadership. And it is being used according, you know, and each time they do this, that they sort of beclown themselves with articles like this, the general public begins to see through it more and more, begins to connect the dots about how, wait a minute, you know, it can't be both A and B when A and B are orthogonal to each other. You can't blame climate change on both. And so it is what it is. It's fascinating to watch. And it is actually pretty interesting to watch the governor of your state, who, of course, is prepping to run for president here pretty soon, and selectively recognizing the reality of physics where it's politically expedient for him to do so, such as, you know, petitioning to keep Diablo Canyon nuclear power operating at least as long as he's governor. And then also, you know, it's frankly not something we'd ever read about, but the National Guard infusion into San Francisco, we just visited that city. It was really remarkable to see the deterioration of that city in the the several years it's been since we've been there. We hadn't been there since before COVID, and really striking to come in as an outsider to see a city that you love. I do love San Francisco, deteriorate so rapidly. It's pretty amazing to watch.
Yeah, it's incredible because you had Amazon closed down, Amazon Fresh. The store was open for 1 year and it was just unsafe. Nordstrom's just closed two stores. You've got CVS and Walgreens moving out of the city because of the crime. It's just not safe. And it's working its way down the state. You're seeing it also in Los Angeles, not safe to go out at night. You're seeing it in parts of downtown San Diego. So it's just spreading all the way. But the thing that really strikes me about all of this, first, they went after fossil fuels. And most people don't realize everything in your home, every place you go to buy something, whether it's a grocery store, department store, got there by truck or some form of fossil fuels that builds this economy that we have. And so they started out with fossil fuels. Now they're going after natural gas. And I wonder if you might comment on this, because when you go to intermittent power, like solar and wind, you have to have backup power, which is primarily your nat gas plants. And they want to do away with nat gas. They want to do away with stovetops using gas. And now they're also going after farming, just like the Netherlands. So it's like they keep adding and making things worse, all in the name of climate change.
Yeah, we wrote a couple of pieces in this regard. You know, natural gas, you mentioned, it's pretty amazing. You know, California and the environmentalists who are sort of powerful in the Democratic Party in the state level, at least, have steadfastly opposed the construction of any and all natural gas pipelines that might connect California to this amazing bounty of natural gas that we have, you know, in Permian and in Appalachia as well. And so we find this circumstance where in Texas, in certain counties in Texas, where natural gas is produced in a form that's known as associated gas, in other words, it's a byproduct of oil drilling, they can't give away the natural gas at the Waha Natural Gas Hub in the Permian Basin. But in SoCal, in California, you know, in December, natural gas was trading for as much as $55 per million BTU, when literally in the Permian Basin, it went negative, Jim. Like, they couldn't give it away because it was holding up production of oil. And absent a simple pipeline infrastructure, California is really an island on its own and must compete with international suitors for LNG and oil, as you mentioned, you know, from the international markets. And then on top of that, we wrote another piece called Eggheads, where we talked about California's war on refineries. And, you know, this amazing coincidence that California is the hardest place in the state to do business as a refiner. And coincidentally, California has the highest price of gas and diesel in the country by a mile. And in the piece, we talked about how California's refinery, you know, its distillation capacity is down by 31% since the 80s. This is at a time where the economy has boomed and the population has grown and so on. Well, at least until recently, the population grew. And this constant unrelenting war on refiners in the state results in refiners leaving the state. And then, of course, you know, Newsom famously tried to pass this bill that would have put government mandated profit caps on refining. And ultimately, that was watered down. And the only thing that passed the state legislature was the creation of new government agencies to measure stuff. And so, you know, we ended up with more bureaucracy. We did spare the refiners of a government mandated price cap, but the entire message coming out of, you know, California and the state led leadership is don't come here to do business, especially if you're in fossil fuels. And then they don't like what happens, which is magically fossil fuels get way more expensive.
Yeah. One of the problems, I think we just, at one time we had 43 refiners. And of course, this newest cap on profits, we've lost two more. The only difference, I think, Doomberg, this time around, with oil, we stopped drilling, but we're buying it from Saudi Arabia. We shut down a nuclear power plant. Well, we're buying nuclear power from Phoenix. The problem with California and its refiners, we have a special blend of gasoline that no other refiner makes. So if we have a refinery go down for maintenance or there's a problem with a refiner, it's not that we can get gasoline into the state through a pipeline or a truck because no other refiners want to make it just for one state.
Correct. So there is unique to California blends that no other refiner produces. And so that does put California in a particularly precarious situation. And of course, I think something like, you know, five companies control 90% of its refining needs. And when you run everybody else out of business, by definition, you just feel an oligopoly, right? And so there's this friction now between the state and these five refiners, Chevron, Marathon, PBF Energy, Phillips 66, and I think Valero are the five that control something like 95 or 98% of the state's refining needs. Well, that's a direct consequence of the state's own policies. And then so, as we like to say, you know, cutting off your toes to spite your feet, you know, it's truly amazing. Like, one wonders, what do they think will come of these policies? Like, it can't be that they don't know that, you know, decisions, you know, we have had a phrase in my old job, decisions, actions, and consequences. You know, you make your decisions, you take your actions, and then there are consequences that flow necessarily from those two things. Leadership of California has made decisions and taken actions. And now when they see the consequences, which are utterly predictable, that flow from those decisions and actions, they don't like, you know, the way the food tastes. And you've got to eat what you have, you know, at some point. And, you know, we shall see. Again, there's this always sort of interesting question that comes inbound. Well, there are two that come inbound to us when we publish pieces like this is, you know, one, is it incompetence or is it malice? And then two, what will it take for, you know, our political leaders to, quote, regress to the mean, to go back to what is sort of the, everyone would objectively agree is sort of a more natural state of affairs. And, you know, we generally come down on the incompetence side. We don't want to live in a world where our political leaders are maliciously imposing bad policy upon us. And what it takes to regress to the mean ultimately comes down to how much pain is imposed by these bad policies and ultimately whether there'll be a political revolt, hopefully peacefully at the ballot box, which is what we think will ultimately have to happen because the alternatives are just too difficult to ponder.
You know, the other thing they haven't clearly thought through, and we're very bullish on commodities, but if you take a look at making this green transition, it takes copper, it takes silver, it takes lithium, cobalt. Good luck trying to open a mine in this country and put it into production. We have Mountain Pass, which has rare earths. Now, they're allowing that to go into production because it's strategic. But if you take a look at it, there's three parts to, let's say, rare earths. There's the mining, the refining, and then turning it into magnets. So right now, we're mining it here, but we're shipping it to China for refining. So all of these strategic materials that make up this green transition, we have to get someplace else, not here.
Well, it's almost always China, as you mentioned. We are now beginning to grow our own rare earth mines, but those only produce concentrates. And to convert a rare earth concentrate into, you know, sufficiently pure metal for use in the development of magnets or for use in electric motors, for example, for all of these electric vehicles that are coming, you do have to ship it to China. In fact, China effectively has a monopoly on that today. And it's the same in solar. You know, if you think about the solar supply chain, it starts with sand, and then you put into that sand an enormous amount of energy, an unthinkable amount of energy to make solar-grade polysilicon. Then you have to take that and you have to form it into ignits, and then you have to slice it into wafers, and then you have to mount it as cells onto, you know, your ultimate panel. And if you look at the supply chain concentration, China controls something like 98% of ignit production and wafering. And so even though we still have three remaining polysilicon plants in the U.S., that polysilicon, undoubtedly, and it has to mathematically, it all ends up in China, commingled with polysilicon produced by the Uyghurs, which the U.S. claims is essentially forced labor, and then gets, you know, converted into these ignits that get sliced into wafers and mounted as cells and sent back here for our so-called green energy. And so China has been very strategic in monopolizing what we call high barrier pinch points. These pinch points in supply chains where they ultimately become the channel captains and they control and extract much of the value from those supply chains, because you could make all the polysilicon you want here. You could make all of the rare earth concentrate you want here, but good luck making a magnet unless you know how to concentrate it. And in fact, one of the reasons why China has taken over these markets is because of NIMBYism, in particular for rare earth metals. Refining is an incredibly dirty process that produces a huge amount of industrial waste, difficult to handle industrial waste, and we don't want to do it here. And China's willing to do it, and they're willing to do it in ways that we would find unacceptable from an environmental stewardship perspective. And yet, because of the magic of the green label, all of these trade-offs get washed away in our unrelenting march towards a green utopian future.
You know, as you look at this, and we talk about some of these things, having the raw materials, number one, but also there's just no way, Doomberg, that 10 years from now, we're going to stop buying gasoline cars. We're going to stop using diesel trucks. And they're taking this, even making this even nuttier by taking our military and making our military go EV. I mean, you know, the military is designed to blow stuff up. How do you do that in an environmentally friendly way?
We wrote a piece in May called Charge with an exclamation point, which was a nice play on words. Yeah, our favorite title, where we talked about Secretary of Energy, Jennifer Granholm, you know, testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee, about how she was convinced, Jim, that we could electrify all the vehicles in the military by 2030, no less, and make them all climate friendly. And then, you know, one wonders whether they were just talking about, you know, non-combat vehicles, you know, trucks and whatnot that exist on bases. But if you listen to Biden's Earth Day speech from 2021. He's very adamant that he means all vehicles. And so in the piece, we said, well, you know, an M1 Abrams tank is a vehicle. Let's look what it would take to electrify that tank. And we did some math. And just to give your listeners a quick summary of that math, an M1 Abrams tank today weighs 60 tons, and about 1.6 tons of that comes from fuel weight. It takes about 500 gallons of diesel to have this tank travel 250 miles down the road. It gets about half that fuel efficiency off-road. And when we back out the math, before considering the fact that the battery has to carry itself, the size of the battery that would be needed to produce the same amount of energy that 500 gallons of diesel puts out, correcting for the improved efficiency of an electric motor versus a diesel engine, works out to be roughly 40 tons. And so you can imagine each Abrams tank has a 40-ton battery in it, probably 50 or 60 when you consider the fact that the battery has to pull the battery. This phenomenon is known as the tyranny of the rocket equation. You know, as your propellant becomes a heavier and heavier part of the cargo, it becomes more and more difficult to fire a rocket. Well, same here on land, a 40-ton battery, you know, welded onto a 60-ton tank is going to require more than a 40-ton battery to move that 100 tons. And like, where do we propose to recharge these things? As you mentioned, like the entire point of war is to basically convey destructive energy to your opponent. And when it comes to war, there's one factor that matters above all else, and it is energy density, which is why nuclear bombs are more powerful than, you know, traditional explosives, which is why nuclear submarines are better than diesel powered ones. And it's why coal-fired ships are better than wind sail ships. And it's why diesel ships outplace coal ships. Like, this is energy density. Literally, war is nothing more than the concentrated conveyance of destructive energy. And the history of war, in fact, can be best understood through this lens of primary energy development, its efficient conversion into weapons, and its resulting targeted delivery against the enemy. You're talking about taking a very high energy density source of fuel, like diesel, and replacing it with batteries, which have a fraction of the energy density. There's a reason why electric vehicles are so much heavier than internal combustion engines. It is what it is. It's kind of fun to go through the math. At the same time, it's kind of sad and scary that we have, you know, leaders in such positions. We say in that piece, you know, that position of energy secretary for the United States is a serious one. And when the person holding that position, you know, vocalizes support for material changes as to how the country military mobilizes, this should be a very serious thing. And yet we've heard crickets in the media about this foolishness that she mentioned before the Senate. It's a truly bonkers idea. It's one of the most insane utterances we've heard in our time. And, you know, it's a shame that this is where we are as a country.
You know, the other thing too is, as you look at this, where is the media in all of this? Because you and I are talking about just how ridiculous and how this stuff isn't working. And when it doesn't work, the catch-all, it's climate change. But where is the media in asking critical questions or doing any critical thinking to inform the population? The population's going to find out about this when things don't work, when they go to the gas station and they're out of gas, or the price of gas doubles, or their utilities, like my natural gas bill is up over 100%. I have solar powered panels. I'm going to have to go buy six more because now California wants to charge residents based on their income. So if you make good income, you're going to pay more so they can give it to people that don't make as much income. So this is how, in reality, people are finding out when you have power outs. But where's the media in all this? And I guess maybe the real media is people like yourself, because you're one of the fastest growing newsletters on Substack.
Yeah, this is the point I was going to make. The media's dereliction of its duty is the market inefficiency that we at Doomberg and others are hoping to occupy. And the data is pretty clear. If it weren't for the lack of a traditional media doing its job, there wouldn't be an opportunity for new voices like us or Michael Schellenberger or Alex Epstein or pick your favorite, Robert Bryce on Substack, another great Substack that your listeners should check out. We have attracted an audience and we have built a great business around speaking authentically about serious subject matters in scientifically based ways that weigh the trade-offs. You know, one of our favorite expressions is there are no solutions, only trade-offs. And we should have adult conversations about those trade-offs and collectively decide, you know, how best to chart a path forward for our society. For example, the big boogeyman of nuclear power is nuclear waste. How big of a trade-off is that compared to having an unstable grid? No single human on the planet has ever provably been injured by nuclear waste. Where does that trade-off rank relative to, you know, somebody who is on a critical device for medical reasons, and if the power goes out, they would pass away within hours? These are real hard questions. We've grown a society that only functions with access to cheap, reliable electricity. You take away either cheap or reliable, and society as we've grown it fails to function properly. How does the relatively manageable nuclear waste issue as a trade-off weigh against the ceasing of a properly functioning society? We would argue, and we do argue, we think, you know, pervasively, that this is a simple equation, but people don't get that type of reporting from the traditional media. Instead, we get sort of platitudes and hand-wavy stuff like the New York Times article blaming the surge in blackouts around the country on something called climate change, as opposed to just actually looking at how the way in which grids are constructed, managed, and what might have changed about the way in which we do those things. And so, you know, again, it always comes back to what level of pain is society willing to absorb before we say enough is enough and we sort of go back to basics and go back to physics as at least an input into our government decisions, if not a guiding factor.
You know, it's amazing because we're talking about all of this doesn't work. And one thing that doesn't work everywhere is EVs. They don't function well in cold weather. So instead of talking about EVs, we should be talking about hybrids. It's interesting about things not working. I just report this morning, Ford lost $3 billion making EVs. It's not profitable. So even at the corporate level, this isn't working. They're not making money doing it.
Yeah. So the counter to that is, oh, this is transition and you have to absorb losses as new technologies get rolled out. And so on, our argument has always been there's a place for batteries in our vehicles. And of course, batteries are the limiting constraint to the development of electrified vehicles. And sort of a classic rule of management is if you have a controlling constraint, you must manage to that constraint. And as you said, the gallons of gasoline abated per pound of battery ought to be the metric that we use when we consider incentives and so on, as we think about reducing the amount of gasoline that we use for transportation. And yet, in almost all Western countries, the focus has been on full battery electric vehicles as opposed to plug-in hybrids, which offer you actually a really amazing balance of performance versus environmental impact. And it really does puzzle us how people can't see the math. I can run the math for you very quickly. If we get you a full battery electric vehicle that has an 80 kilowatt hour battery in it, we will abate the gasoline use of 100% of one driver. And if we divide that battery into four 20 kilowatt hour batteries and put them into plug-in hybrid engineering constructs, we will abate, let's say, 80% of four drivers' gasoline use. When I grew up, 80 times four is 320, which is 3.2 times more than 100. So for the same amount of battery, we could abate three times as much gasoline if we quit our obsession with full BEVs, and instead let physics dictate how we should get the most out of the limited battery materials that we have. Now, this type of common sense approach is very rare in the media and even rarer in politics. And unfortunately, the two sort of feed off each other. But so California can outlaw internal combustion engines. The EPA can roll out incredibly strict tailpipe emission guidelines that effectively rule out internal combustion engines. The net consequence of that is they're ruling out the sale of new vehicles. And we shall see whether the population is ready to become Cuba, where we all wrench on the same cars for decades at a time because we can no longer buy new cars, and at least the old ones are grandfathered in.
How long do you actually think this goes on before it just gets to the breaking point? You know, like right now, we're being told to brace ourselves for power outs this summer because our grid has become more destabilized, obviously, as they shut down more power plants. The price of gasoline, we expect to go up in the fall. We're just watching the fundamentals on inventories. We're seeing the price of everything. We expect a big upsurge in copper. We're watching inventories there. In other words, Doomberg, at what point do we get to the breaking point? Because they certainly aren't hearing the things you and I are talking about right now. They're experiencing them with higher gas prices, higher nat gas prices, higher utility prices, and coming soon, power outs.
Yeah, I would say, you know, to the original question, how much longer? You know, we saw political strategic retreats, say, on the part of Biden when gas really exploded in price early last year. And recently, with your governor, Gavin Newsom, on the nuclear issue, I do think that in the U.S. in particular, the cultural expectation of cheap and plentiful, abundant energy is sort of embedded in our culture as a fundamental right. It is ingrained in what it means to be American. America is a huge country with an unbelievable interstate highway system. The car is really a symbol of personal freedom and autonomy. And yeah, there are certainly very loud voices that live in cities that walk everywhere and live in high rises. But the vast majority of the country has grown up living a certain way, and ultimately probably won't be dictated to by those city dwellers on how they should go about living their lives. And so whether it be the mandated phase out of furnaces or the mandated phase out of internal combustion engines, I mean, at some point, Biden retreated so quickly on gas prices, you know, emptying the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, calling on the oil companies to produce more, you know, Newsom's retreat on nuclear power. Ultimately, politically, it won't be survivable if the pain keeps ramping up. And as the pain keeps ramping up, these weak attempts at propaganda, like we saw in the New York Times, blaming it all on sort of global warming just won't cut it. And I do think that, you know, the pendulum swings. You've been around long enough to know that the pendulum swings. And when enough pain is felt, we do think that the pendulum will swing back towards physics and away from platitudes.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think more pain's ahead of us. Doomberg, as we close, tell our listeners about your newsletter. I love reading your articles because you cover topics, things that are relevant, and explain the world around us, why things aren't working.
Yeah, doomberg.substack.com. It's the work, you know, we have a phrase here in the office. When you find out what you were meant to be doing in life, keep doing it. And this is what we were meant to be doing in life. We were meant to be researching, writing, editing, promoting these pieces. We have a great mix of science and finance and writing and editing and humor on this team. These pieces are the expression of our combined talent. We have a great audience. We're the number one finance Substack in the world, which is amazing considering that we only launched 2 years ago and only went paid 1 year ago. We've been told unofficially that we're easily into the top five across the entire Substack platform. We do believe that platforms like Substack are the future of media. You know, as computers take over society and automate everything, there's a huge demand for all things authentically human. We write from the authentically human voice. We're professional content creators now. This is all we do. It's the work of our lives. We're thrilled and humbled and blessed to be able to do it. And, you know, thrilled and humbled and blessed to be on podcasts like yours, Jim. So really appreciate the opportunity and looking forward to chatting again soon.
Likewise. Once again, you can find them on Substack. And if you want truth in media, it should be one of the first places you go to. Doomberg, all the best and love to have you back again.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.